Colonel, I thought just to be safe, you know? There's a movie scene in there, I'm sure. Welcome back. Just to wrap up a little bit, so far we've looked at the printing process and the Italian economy and on the developments in the design of the violin, and also on how the bit players in history end up playing huge parts, whether they're publishers or hairdressers or bureaucrats. Those people seem to make almost as much a difference as the musicians involved. Now, all three of those issues, the Italian economy, violin development, and the printing process, all come together for a few very important years around 1710, and they have a big impact on everything that follows. First of all, in 1708, there was a young composer who moved from Mühlhausen to Weimar to a new job. He's looking for a better job, and his job was the house organist for the Duke of Weimar. And one of the Duke's sons, there were quite a few of them, they were always fighting with each other, one of them was a very keen musician. That was Prince Johann Ernst. He composed his own music, apparently he was a pretty good violinist too, and the prince also traveled for lessons. So he went out looking for new teachers or new music to play. And that's why he went to Utrecht in Holland for 2 years starting in 1709. Now that same year, in Venice, the brilliant violinist, priest, and composer Antonio Vivaldi was fired, essentially, from his teaching job at Ospedale della Pietà. We don't really know why he was fired. It was probably a bureaucratic initiative of one kind or another. He'd been teaching at La Pietà for 6 years. There are two possible reasons why he was fired. One was that he wouldn't say the Mass. He refused to say the Mass, even though he was a priest. He said it was because of a respiratory ailment, but, you know, how much is that really going to tax your respiratory system to say the Mass? Not that much, I don't think. There are rumors he was involved with a female soprano, maybe so he thought he'd better stay away from saying the Mass until that was done. There are also some thoughts that perhaps the people at the governors of La Pietà let him go because, as a music teacher, it didn't seem he was necessary anymore. He was such a good teacher, and the orchestra at La Pietà was so good that it seemed like he kind of taught himself out of a job. At any rate, at the time, the economy in Northern Europe was much better than it was in Italy and in Venice. That same economic slowdown was still really in place. So Vivaldi very likely visited those places looking for work in those 2 years, 1709. What he found, though, was a busy and music-loving upper class. So instead of moving north to play for those people, he simply sold them his music. In 1711, Vivaldi published a set of violin concertos that were directed to amateur musicians. Said so right on the front. And he published them without using the famous Venetian printers, whose type method was going out of style. Vivaldi hated it. All these little bits for the note heads. There were little bits of type for note heads, for rests, all lines, all the stems for all the notes, and consequently, lots of messy stuff and lots of errors. Vivaldi far preferred the work of the master engraver from Holland, Estienne Roget, who we met in the first half. And it was Roget that published Vivaldi's Opus 3 concertos. So that same year, 1711, our Weimar prince, Johann Ernst, finished his lessons in Utrecht and went to Amsterdam looking for some music to play. And he bought a copy of Vivaldi's concertos from Estienne Roget, and he brought them home and shared them with the young house organist back in Weimar, whose name was Johann Sebastian Bach. Thank you. And that's music by Vivaldi, the violin concerto, opus 3, number 3. But that could be by Johann Sebastian Bach. And in fact, when Bach got that music from Prince Johann Ernst, he was thrilled by it. It was just what he wanted at the time. And he copied out several of those concertos for his own use to be played in the harpsichord. And here's how it sounds when it's, here's how it sounds when it's played like that. So that's Bach's transcription of Vivaldi's music. And you can really imagine, I can really imagine Bach alone, he's in his late 20s by then, and really looking for a musical direction in life. You can imagine him discovering this stuff. He was just thrilled at what Vivaldi's music taught him. And it only happened because the Ospedale di Pietà fired Vivaldi for whatever reason. The economic slowdown meant that he went north looking for more for greener pastures. The printers were better in Holland, and there just happened to be a prince traveling through who picked it up, who happened to be in the same household as Bach for this very short time. Just a remarkable string of coincidences. And it had a, well, it had a vast impact on, not just on Bach's music, but as he did, on everything that followed in Western music. Here's what one of Bach's early biographers in 1802 said about the impact of the Vivaldi pieces on Johann Sebastian Bach. Bach considered his early compositions to be that of a finger composer, letting his fingers run wild over the keyboard. But Bach soon began to feel that there must be order, connection, and proportion in the thoughts, and that some kind of guide was necessary to reach those goals. Vivaldi's concertos for the violin serve him for such a guide. Thank you. They were about to be invented, I'm sure. So, is that okay? Okay. Yeah, don't try to move all the stands. Okay. Came from the stage manager. Okay, shall I continue? Now, by 1711, the governors at La Pietra in Venice came back to their senses and they voted Antonio Vivaldi back onto their staff. He stayed there at La Pietra on and off for the next 29 years, although he still never said the Mass, and we're not quite sure how long that relationship with the female singer, if that's what was happening, continued. But he seemed like a relatively happy guy most of the time. He became an opera impresario in Venice, and a very successful one. And he also nurtured a relationship. He became an impresario and a very successful one. And he put on operas, he produced his own operas. But he was still kind of at the edge of acceptable in terms of the church's eyes, to the point that the Pope banned one of his operas at one point. And Vivaldi went at that point, where his music had been printed first and where he knew he was really understood, back to Amsterdam. That was in 1738. So by then, Estienne Roger, the engraver, had died. Was a very died a wealthy man, and he left the engraving business to his son-in-law, Le Sen. Now, Le Sen showed signs of 20th century business practice by simply reprinting Roger's excellent work to an ever-growing public, much in the way Columbia, their library of CDs has been expanded by Sony. They just took all that stuff that already existed and just printed it in brand new editions and sold it all over again. No overhead, all profit. Brilliant. So Roger's work went on and on and on, and Le Sen published Corelli's music, one of those original Roger productions, and all of Vivaldi's, and coasted pretty much there to the end. So meanwhile, in Cremona, Antonio Stradivari was doing no such thing. The economy was still in serious trouble there, but Stradivari's violin shop was hard at work. He was putting out 30 violins and cellos a year at that point. He literally put the Amati family out of business. They'd been in trouble, and they took a loan from Stradivari, and they couldn't repay it, and eventually they folded under until the Stradivari violin shop was the only one left in Cremona. In that same year, 1738, the Stradivari workshop produced the Viotti. The one violin that the Royal Academy of London is still trying to hang on to. They've got a massive fundraising drive that's on right now until the end of March to try to raise enough money to buy the thing back from auction. And it's valued currently at £3.5 million. They think it might go for twice that if it went up to auction. In 1714, Stradivari was 70 years old and began his last extraordinary push to perfect his already perfect violins. He was a control freak and a perfectionist and a very rich man. That year, 1714, he invested in a pastry shop in Cremona with some of extra money, and he also bought a garden plot outside the city walls. But none of that took very much of his attention, because mostly he worked. He ignored everything else. Mostly his family, he ignored the city. He even ignored most of the musicians who were flocking to his workshop from all over Europe. Now, one of those was another very important bit player in the life and music of Johann Sebastian Bach, and that was the Flemish-born violinist Jean-Baptiste Volumier. He was court music director in Dresden. He'd been trained in France, so although he loved the violin, he always thought of it as an instrument for dance, a peasant instrument best used for dance. So when he put together his Dresden orchestra, he had to play in a French style, all pomp and dance, but using Italian violins. And he got those violins from Stradivari's workshop in 1715, when the old master was at his best. Volumier waited 3 months in Cremona, and he left with 12 Stradivari violins, 12 of the world's greatest violins, best ever made, in his possession. And when he got back to Dresden, everyone there was blown away, including the young Johann Sebastian Bach, who just happened to be hanging around there for, again, a short time between jobs. So can you imagine 12 Stradivarius violins in the same orchestra? That's what, for Johann Sebastian Bach, a violin sounded like. That was an orchestra. full of the greatest instruments ever made. He never thought of the violin in the same way again. music by Johann Sebastian Bach. Now, Bach moved to Köthen in 1717. He was in his mid-30s by then and had a growing family. And he took a new job as the court music director for the barely 20-year-old Prince Leopold, who was a likable fellow and who loved music. He was a keen musician. And 3 years later, though, that same prince married, and his wife apparently hated music and wasn't big on Bach either. So Bach's wife, Maria Barbara, had died earlier that year, and those two things were enough to have him looking for a change again. So he remarried just 8 months later to Anna Magdalena, the daughter of a court trumpeter, which, you know, we could argue was just the way things were. I'm sure he didn't marry her because her dad was a court trumpeter, but he ended up writing music for the trumpet in a very different way after that, so I'm sure it had some influence. 3 years later, when he finally got a new job, he and Anna Magdalena and their growing pile of children moved to Leipzig. And there was an incredible court trumpeter who, if he wasn't a father figure to Bach, ended up being a father figure for every trumpet player who has lived since. Gottfried Reicha was the trumpet king of Leipzig. He was the first call trumpeter in every sense. He was so valued to the city that the city council actually paid him not to play, just so he wouldn't look for work anywhere else. He got paid just for being in Leipzig. He was almost 20 years older than Bach, and Bach was just hitting his compositional stride at the point. And this Bach used every ounce of this new court trumpeter's genius. The parts that Bach wrote were dazzling and fast. And in some ways, you could argue that Reicha, his greatness, actually slowed the trumpet's progress down in terms of the technological development of the instrument. Because the instrument that Reicha played was just a long coiled tube. He had such ability that he could play almost anything on it. So it was another 70 years before anybody bothered trying to improve the system. It had worked so well for Reicha, it ought to be good for anybody. So if Stradivari raised the violin with his workshop tools, Reicha kept the trumpet where it was with the strength of his chops. And in the end, it actually cost Reicha. Gottfried Reicha died of a brain hemorrhage in 1734. The injury very likely brought on by the incredible music written for him by one very demanding organist. Thank you. Back in 1718, when Bach was still working for the young, still unmarried, music-loving Prince Leopold in Köthen, the prince went to Carlsbad. There was a sulfur spring there, a hot spring where the waters were supposed to be medicinal, taking the waters, they called it. And so the prince went to went to the springs, and he thought, well, I better bring along some musicians with him. So he brought along his harpsichord and six musicians. One of them was Bach. It's a very rich picture. You can imagine next time you want to take a bath, bring along six musicians and a harpsichord just to make yourself feel comfortable. That's the stage of life he was at. Somewhere around that trip, he turned up in Berlin, and he paid to have some work done at the bindery. And Bach was there to pick it up. Now, the simplicity of Estienne Roger's engraving technique had long won the printing war. It's kind of counterintuitive, because although people were excited about the printing press and all of the little bits of type and all, the basic fact was that you could do a better job with music with an engraver. It just was more easy to do, and so it spread more, and there was more and more music engraved, to the point that Bach actually ended up doing his own engravings after a while. And that's likely what he was having printed at the bindery in Berlin. One of the pieces that he printed himself, engraved himself and printed in Berlin, was the E minor solo partita for violin. Inspired by the wonderful possibilities he discovered when he heard those 12 Stradivarius violins in the orchestra in Dresden. He revised the piece in the mid-1730s, about the time that Antonio Stradivari died at the incredible age of 93. You know, he never stopped working. Stradivari never did. Even in his last year of life, at 93, he made three instruments. Just a phenomenal, hard-working genius who clearly was in love with what he did. So the tenderness of this piece and the fact that Bach revisited it around the time that the great master died is wonderfully suggestive. And it also brings on another possibility. Because back in 1720, in January, when he first wrote the piece, he went back with the prince to the springs in Carlsbad for several months. And while he was gone, his wife, Maria Barbara, died. It was so sudden. She died so suddenly that Bach missed the funeral and the burial. She was already buried when he got back to try and catch up with what was happening. You can imagine the heartbreak. He remarried and enjoyed a famously successful partnership with singer and copyist and teacher Anna Magdalena. But if you listen to the music that he wrote around the time of Maria Barbara's sudden death, it's easy to see how a lone violin, with all of its warmth and sensuality, still spoke to him and to generations of musicians after, like no other instrument ever would. Thank you.
Are you back?
You get a bow, right? And you already did, I guess. And then I'm just...
I'm still not quite clear about what the light's doing. I'm supposed to bow, and then the light's going down, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I'll just follow you off, and we'll do the whole...
Let me go on.
You go off. Tell me you're going to move into the
middle. Yeah. Oh, yeah, right. Yes, I am. Okay. Cross frame, right. Yes. Right. That's it. Yep. Good. Thanks. Makes sense?
Half an hour later.
Good, yeah. Is it too much to follow, or does it hang together?